So good morning. I'm glad everyone was able to make it today. And you're all in luck because both April and I are from the New York region, so we have a tendency to talk quickly. So I'm going to try to be mindful and just kind of slow down a bit here. There's a lot of information that I'm sharing with you today. Keep in mind, too, these presentations were all uploaded, so you can always at your own pace go download them, look at it, especially with some of the data slides I'm going to be sharing with you. We had to say no disclosures, so for the formality, we have that. So really what I wanted to cover today, and April just talked about this briefly, but really to understand what are the disaster behavioral health needs that exist, and again, you'll hear us keep saying it, disaster behavioral health, at least as it's defined in the context that we work in, is the collaboration of mental health and substance abuse together. That's what comprises behavioral health. What we really wanted to find out was what were the needs of states and territories and local level providers for their response needs and their preparedness needs for a disaster. Then we also, I'll be highlighting from the Crisis Counseling Program, which you're going to hear us refer to as CCP. So from the CCP program, what's the utilization of that service? What do the needs of disaster survivors, what are they and how can we address it? And so I put together a slide here that I was hoping, maybe in a fun way and somewhat a little, poking a little fun as you see if you can see the images here, but looking at states and territories, your local level providers, those are the people that have the crisis counselors that go out in the field, or maybe they're the ones who are set up for more longer term referrals, they're doing the treatment, but then also the disaster survivors. But on the bottom is the most important piece here where you see that arrow. That's disaster behavioral health. It cuts across all of those. So not to say siloed, and that the importance of what happens on the preparedness feeds into the response and vice versa. So almost thinking about it cyclically, that they all interact. So this is a framework, so think as I go through and you'll hear all the data, but please be thinking about what does that do, how does that affect response, and what does that mean for survivors? And I'm going to try to bring that together at the end of my presentation. So starting first with our National Needs Assessment Survey, again, we were looking at what are the response needs and the preparedness needs. This was a strategic initiative by SAMHSA. Very often, I'm, as you heard April describe, I'm someone who is from the field. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I worked in community-based settings. And people would often complain and say, well, how do we have a voice? Who's going to hear? We're working day to day. Well, SAMHSA really recognized the importance of we want to hear how those who are directly doing this work, how are they affected and how can we support them? And so that's something really to be proud of from the federal level that we're going to have this information and it's going to inform policy and it's going to inform service and outcomes. And that's some of what we're doing through the SAMHSA Disaster Technical Assistance Center. And then the second piece in terms of looking at what kinds of training and technical assistance, what needs to get developed, and most importantly, if you look at that last line there, it's all hazards. And you'll hear Mr. Brown discuss that somewhat later as well, again, about that public health and behavioral health integration. We can't stay siloed anymore. So in terms of our methodology, we developed several surveys. These were all web-based surveys. So people could go online. There was always a paper version that was available. We had that in the situation for anyone it was usually either English or Spanish for the territories. So if something needed to get translated, we had that available as well. We wanted this to be accessible. And so we did a state territory coordinator needs assessment survey, the local provider needs assessment survey. And then what we wanted to do, we said, great, we have all this wonderful quantitative data. We have our numbers. But, that only tells so much, right? I mean, think about in our field, a lot of it is the stories. It's the experience. And so we followed up with two types of interviews. Again, we had, and I'll get into that in a minute, but we had interviews with the states and territory, a smaller subsample, and a smaller subsample with local providers. We went through the IRB and OMB process, if people are familiar with that. So we did that on both sides, too, to make sure everything was covered. Also, keep in mind, please, here, so if this is with the state territory needs assessment, we reached out to the state territory coordinators. We didn't want to stay, again, thinking, we know best. We wanted to reach out and say to the coordinators, we want to know what's important to you. What should we be asking? Or here's what we're thinking about asking. Are we asking this the right way? Will other people understand the language that we're using? And that was really, really important for developing a very valid tool. I mean, that's something of the expertise that we have within our team. So there's a lot here on the slide, but as you see, we get your basic demographics about the participants. We divided things between preparedness and response, and as you see the next bullets, again, your behavioral health, your mental health, and your substance abuse questions, specific incidents and populations that they work with, collaboration efforts, their awareness of SAMHSA Disaster Technical Assistance Center, did they even know that those resources existed and for free? And then general open-ended comments. That's an important one, too. I don't know if you've ever taken a survey. You get through it, you get to the end, and they don't even give you an opportunity to say anything. Well, we really wanted to hear what people had to say. Keep in mind, because this is behavioral health, and every state and every territory operates differently. They have the right to do that. Their needs are different. In some states, you'll have a behavioral health coordinator, so they're responsible for both mental health and substance abuse. Other states, they're separated. And so we didn't want everybody to have to be asked all the questions, so we had skip logic patterns. So if your area was just disaster substance abuse, those were the only questions you got. We weren't going to ask you about mental health that wasn't your area. So we can do that with technology, thankfully. So for the local provider needs assessments, those question topics, again, something similar, demographic characteristics, again, preparedness and response, and then how familiar were they with SAMHSA DTEC? The follow-up interviews, our methodology, we really wanted to keep it short, sweet. People have limited amount of time and they're busy. They are 45 to 60-minute questions. The protocol was designed specifically to include how many disasters had they been involved with, participation, did they or didn't they participate in the web survey? So we realized, again, people are busy. They didn't participate in the survey. Well, we still wanted to hear what they had to say. So we actually had in our sample a number of people who had not taken the web-based survey, but we still did the interview with them because we really wanted to get their opinion. Geographic region and then their job title. So for the state territory coordinators, again, we had the census with DBH, DMH, and DSA. At the time that we started this, I think there were about 79 or 80 coordinators nationally, and so we had 42 that participated in the online survey, so that's a 53% rate for response. And you see here in terms of most of them were DBH coordinators, so they had both hats on, and it was great. They represented all 10 FEMA regions, so we really got a nice representation of needs across the country. For the local providers, we were able to get this data. We went to the coordinators and said, thank you so much for participating. Who are the local providers that you're working with? Can we have their contact information? And so we went that way, and we had 279 local providers from 26 different states. We didn't have territories in the sample. We had 55 that completed the online survey. As you can see, in terms of job roles, 60% dealing with behavioral health, so mental health and substance abuse. And here we had 9 out of the 10 FEMA regions represented. And then for the follow-up, the interviews, we had 6 total representing a mix of states from high, mid, and low disasters. Again, trying to get a sample. So if you're someone who's constantly at a state like Louisiana or Texas and California with your earthquakes, you're exposed to it more than perhaps Maine, some other states that are not as active. So we wanted to get that perspective as well. And for local providers, we had 5 from a mix of states, again, with a variety. And then this is an interesting one. It's kind of a sobering statistic. It may be something that we know, but again, it's nice to have it validated. So when you look at how these places are staffed, they have some staff that do preparedness, some do response, some do both. When you look here, half of the states and territories, local providers have 5 or fewer staff. That's it for their whole state, 5 or fewer. And 56% of state territory staff spend less than half of their time on preparedness. Now, for local providers, 65% spend 10% of their time on DBH preparedness. That's it. That's it for preparedness. And, again, remember, preparedness, that's going to affect response. So then on the response side, 87% of state territory coordinators have 1 or 2 staff members. That's it. 39 local providers have 5 or fewer. I mean, I'll let you, you can read the rest here, but it's a sobering statistic and something to think about when we talk about policy and you talk about implications and implementation. How do you do what needs to get done when this is what your staffing looks like? So what are our findings? And I'll be covering the first three in this presentation today. But there's a need for collaboration, right? I mean, that last slide, it kind of begs that point. We need to be collaborating together in both public and private organizations. There's a need for assistance with funding, how to navigate the funding mechanism, how do you apply for a CCP grant, what other monies are out there, how do you work together on state level, county level, or across states. An example you'll see in the East Coast of all the different states that are impacted, how can they work also collaboratively together to learn from each other and to have a successful response. And then the in-person training and technical assistance is a preferred route, but how do you do that when there's such limited funds? So collaboration needs, I'm going to just try to get through these sort of quickly, but you'll see we included here, we did a Likert scale, we had a 5-point Likert scale. So the top needs for state and territory coordinators, help conducting DBH preparedness exercises and preparedness training. Again, states, territories have disaster plans. If they're not exercising them, how good are they? How helpful are they? So the need to exercise them. Support for interstate information sharing, similar to what I was just saying, how to talk to other states and learn their lessons learned so that it can get incorporated to that state. Generating buy-in from external entities. You know, again, we have that stigma of behavioral health. There's such stigma with us and people don't, oh, well, how do we incorporate them? What do we do? People forget about us. And as April said earlier about ESF-8, so the importance of making sure that there's that that integration. So there were three DBH preparedness challenges related to collaboration that were identified. No surprise. And again, I think a lot of this we might know intuitively, but it's nice to finally have it validated. So I do want that to be the point that people really can take away here today. We now have it. We know it. We have the data. It speaks to it. Getting local government to incorporate DBH. Ensuring volunteers and partners are trained, right? If you don't have staff that know what to do when your disaster strikes, you're already, you know, so far behind in really having a good response. Getting community mental health and substance abuse or behavioral health centers to participate in preparedness. How do you help people realize how important these topics are? For collaboration needs, so again, additional and short-term DBH response activities of supporting providers and meeting the needs of clients who have pre-existing behavioral health or substance abuse concerns. You heard April talk about that a few minutes ago when she gave her introduction. This is very important to keep in mind when we're preparing and then responding to a disaster. State, territory, mental health, this is now just DMH folks as opposed to the behavioral health. So they need help support for increasing policy requirements for DBH preparedness. So if the policy doesn't exist, their hands are tied as to what they could actually be involved with. Also additional collaboration now for substance abuse folks that participated. This was obtaining MOUs or other forms of formal agreements, right, of organizations to shelter active substance abusers. When you have a disaster, where are you going to help all these people? Where can you refer them or send them to get them care? They need for instructional materials about substance abuse preparedness. Often it's overlooked. Even in behavioral health, we talk about mental health. Even with my own team, I'm often saying, remember, we also have substance abuse here. And so there's a stigma there, too, that we need to be aware of. And so the coordinators talked about that. Competency-based training, informing the public regarding capabilities of responders. I mean, I think that one speaks volumes as well. This one also, rural areas. And I know this is a key point for some of you in the audience. There's a need on training on technical assistance. How do you address behavioral health preparedness with your rural communities? How do you access them? How do you reach out to them? How do you engage them? And how do you help them? Language barriers. I love this quote. I mean, it basically says, it's great, we get these materials in English and Spanish, but there's so many other languages we need. When the Gulf Coast oil spill happened, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, SAMHSA turned to SAMHSA DTAC and said, we need you to translate materials. I think we had, I don't know, 8 different languages, and we did that instantly and got that in this community, because again, that information was so vital for people's recovery. And that there's a strong need to collaborate with tribes, and you'll hear this more and more. And we were even talking this morning with the disaster with Sandy in the state of Connecticut, which had a disaster declaration. There are 2 tribes there that are included in that declaration. So how do we reach out to those communities that have needs and are often overlooked? For funding-related needs, there's a lack of sufficient funding. We need to allocate funds for updating DBH plans. This was a huge one for us that we heard a lot about. The plans exist, but they need to be updated, and people don't have money, and they don't have staff to do it. So what do? Funding for various training activities, so approaches to funding state and territory-level trainings for their partners. That was top for disaster behavioral health preparedness. Support for providing free mental health, disaster mental health training to staff. Again, emphasis on free. So how do we help them to do this? And then funding related needs for, this is the funding mechanism. So navigating the system, trying to understand how do you get access in terms of response activities. This is the funding mechanism, so in a lot having to do with CCP grants and understanding that process. They need more information on that. And this is an interesting one, that in terms of what's the most useful method of delivery of how to learn something? Well, supposedly it's what we're doing right now, although probably what people would like is if we were sitting more in a circle. We're unfortunately forced here because it's recording. I can't come out and sit down and have more of an engagement with you. But being attending a conference is the preferred method for everybody. Everyone who could come here and you network and you talk and you have that one-on-one opportunity. If you look at the bottom of this, articles, fact sheets, you know, how do you get trained by reading an article? So that's not the most effective method. So this is something that we're trying to keep in mind, too, of how do we provide these services. So looking forward, I thought this was a pretty powerful comment. This is a quote from the field. Funds of mental health and substance abuse services have been declining while demand for service has increased. It's very difficult to prepare for disaster behavioral health needs when there is substantial unmet need during normal conditions. The state health department simply does not have sufficient funding to do this, and neither do local authorities or providers. And that's looking forward, right? That's like, where do we go from here? So that represents the state, the local providers, and the territories. I'm going to move in next onto the CCP program, and let me show you what we're finding about utilization of that program from the disaster survivors. How am I doing on time? Good?
You have about 6
more. Okay. All right. So April already went over this in terms of the CCP program, a bit of a background. So you have this again if you were to download. You can look back at it further. But I think a key here about the short-term behavioral health support is one of the important messages to think about. In terms of its mission, the important key piece here is really about this is a public health model. This is a community model. It's assessing the psychosocial needs, and then the idea is then to refer. And the key pieces with CCP, also, before I move into this, just keep in mind the crisis counselors come from the community in which the disaster existed. So where it was hit. So it's people from their own community going and helping their neighbors, their peers, people in their community. I will be presenting data that goes into two phases here. The ISP, which is the Immediate Service Program, which is a grant. This is, again, where Captain Robinson talked about, funded through FEMA, administered by SAMHSA. So that's the immediate. And then after that, it goes into the Regular Services Program, which typically can last up to 9 months. Some of these go longer, but this just to give you a framework. So ISP, I'll be talking about short-term, RSP, long-term. We use data collection forms our crisis counselors use. It's observation data as they're having their meetings with the disaster survivors. They fill out the forms. I brought examples with me. The data I'm showing today is just covering the first three. In terms of the composition, this is data that is about 31 different CCPs starting from disasters from September 2009 through this past August. We excluded American Samoa and Puerto Rico from our sample because it was a very different data set, and it was an outlier, and it will be, like I said, it's a whole other presentation, so we look forward to presenting that another time, but to really truly see what we wanted to show, those two samples were excluded. And we were looking at differences, ISP to RSP, and then level of risk and reaction following a disaster. So these I'm going to go through. These are very quick. These are just snapshots. This just simply shows most of where the CCP individual encounters take place. And you'll see up on top individual encounters where the crisis counselor is interacting with a person is usually at someone's home. So it's home, and it's home with one person or home with child. So it's almost 50%. And that does not change from ISP to RSP. The type of visit, as I just said, individual encounter, you'd expect to see this, ISP to RSP, really no difference. In terms of the number of visits in the ISP, it's really about, it's almost like triage, getting out there, assessing, moving on, referring. When you get into RSP, you're having, as you see, there's a slight decrease in the first visit, and what you want to see is an increase that if they've identified people who need additional help, we've been able to go back and reach them. So that's confirmed here. In terms of age groups, you've got adults primarily here, and it's pretty much the same from ISP to RSP, the purple and the light blue as the adults. So not much else to show on that. For gender composition, and this holds true to what the data shows in terms of the research, more women are engaging in these programs than men. There can be various reasons for that we're going to continue to look at. A lot of the research shows that women are more affected and have more negative experiences. Maybe it's also women are more willing to engage in the services than men. Racial composition, majority of the people that are participating in the services, it's are white, and then African American stays pretty much the same from ISP to RSP. Ethnicity, majority are not Hispanic, so the red slice is the Hispanic or Latino. Referral type, so this gets at looking at are they going into the crisis counseling program or community. I think the thing to really highlight here is in the ISP you have many more on the community services, the purple slice there, and that's what you'd expect because this is really more about getting the immediate needs met. And then when you get into RSP, these programs are set up and it's really getting services from the CCP program. So that's what we would want to see. In terms of risk score, this is how close, how impacted were people to the disaster. In RSP, it was higher, which is interesting. And we really think some of this has to do with certain risks, like maybe financial loss. You know, they lost their job, and in the immediacy, they don't really know the impact, but as time has gone on, they're doing worse, right? That risk has intensified. Then the risk score by disaster type was interesting, somewhat different than what other data we've seen, but here are those in tornadoes and wildfires had the highest risk. And we did some statistical analyses, and they showed any of these pairs are statistically significant in their difference. Reactions, so in terms of cognitive, physical, emotional, or behavioral reaction, we see that in RSP, they are higher in cognitive and emotional. And then in terms of groups, group encounters, there's public education, and April talked about this a little bit in the beginning. There's more engagement, but it's pretty consistent. You're seeing a little bit more happening in the RSP. The location of the groups, think about what you just saw the previous in terms of public education. Look at that for RSP. That's pretty significant, really getting into the schools, which is very important when we look at, and there's lots of sessions that are taking place. The blue here is first session, and you'll see that then the second session, there is at times, there is an increase in people engaging, the idea being we have now identified those people who are really needing additional help. But the public education groups here, again, you're seeing more people participating in RSP than ISP. It's a nice affirmation that people who need the program are involved. The group composition, you saw the one public education and access to the schools, so here, RSP, look at that, almost half of that pie is children or youth, so it's 18 and younger. This one is a very important slide on the right-hand side, the children and youth. This is a special scale for the adult with the Sprint E, if people are familiar with that, with NCPTSD, and then child and youth out of NCTSN, the UCLA PTSD index. That's what we use. And look at where the children are. If you look at that on the bottom right in RSP, these are kids who are showing that they really have issues and they're having a hard time and they're getting referred. So to quickly just summarize, because it's a lot of pie charts, and as I said, you can download these if you want to study it further for each of the places, but there are more women than men that are both in the ISP and RSP. More children are referred, so these have serious implications when we're thinking about public health and we're thinking about integrating in the preparedness side. And then more referrals take place in community centers in the beginning, but then as time goes on, it's in that CCP program. You have more schools, and groups that are happening in RSP. Public safety workers, which is key for public health. When is the best time to really access them? In the beginning, during ISP. They're not involved in RSP. So if you want to really look at their needs and you want to help them, it's in the ISP level. And obviously additional analyses need to take place for us to really look at this deeper, but this gives really a great beginning look at how these programs are being utilized. The project officers that I report to at SAMHSA, their names are here, and they said if you have any questions, please feel free to contact them. They're happy to answer any questions. This is just my contact information, and also if you go on EPHA, I uploaded these two brochures that you can download. I have some today if you want to take. One describes DTEC and one describes CCP, so you have that. And that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.